The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post and the New York Times. Now, before we begin on our journey for today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And to begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, we will join writer Alexandra Petchy and her family as they share their experiences touring ancient sites in England. Miss Petchy's daughter has a walking disability, which led to the article, which is titled Making Ancient Sites Accessible in England. This was published October 23, 2019 in the Washington Post. We begin. The thought of visiting Tintagel Castle is enough to send shivers down any Arthurian legend lover's spine, but as my family prepared to visit England this past summer, we discovered two problems with a potential visit there. Steps were the first issue. As many as 242 steps up and down, in fact, depending on the route visitors take to access the medieval clifftop fortification on the rugged Cornwall coast. My 10-year-old daughter, Chloe, has a walking disability and gets around using forearm crutches and a lightweight transport chair. I knew such a climb would put the ruins out of reach for us, but there was another happier reason we couldn't visit. Tintagel Castle was closed for construction because English Heritage, the charity that manages Tintagel, and more than 400 other historic properties, was building a footbridge linking the mainland to the headland where the ruins are located, finally allowing visitors with walking disabilities to bypass the steps and experience Tintagel Castle up close. The new footbridge opened August 11th, just 3 days after my mom, Chloe, and I returned home from our British adventure. Although it's made of steel, local Cornish slate, and oak, the new structure isn't a modern intrusion. Instead, it recreates a narrow land bridge that was used during the Middle Ages until it was lost to erosion sometime in the 15th or 16th century. It means that for the first time, visitors can experience the castle as a whole, as it was originally conceived, and crucially, without having to tackle the steep steps, which were the only option previously, Liz Page, a historic properties director for English Heritage, said via email. Tintagel Castle isn't alone. We discovered that all the ancient sites we visited in England are actively working to add features to increase accessibility without compromising the historical integrity of their buildings or landscapes. Retrofitting existing structures for handicapped accessibility can be challenging under the best of circumstances. But when those structures and sites are millennia-old places of worldwide historical importance that are also protected by laws like the UK's Ancient Monuments and Archaeological Areas Act of 1979, which limit the changes that can be made, the task is even more daunting. Take the Tower of London, where the entire site is protected, including its buildings, archaeology, and even the cobblestones. Alfred Hawkins, historic buildings curator for Historic Royal Places, the charity that manages the tower, said via email. Besides, the Tower of London wasn't exactly built with friendliness in mind. It was, among other things, a prison, after all. As a fortress, its architecture has been designed with the single requirement of making access difficult or impossible, Hawkins said. Indeed, all of the ancient sites we visited, the Tower of London was the most difficult to get around with crutches and a wheelchair, even with the help of the detailed 9-page access guide we received on arrival. There were uneven, cobbled surfaces, tight spiral staircases, and buildings that were almost completely inaccessible, like the White Tower built by William the Conqueror and today housing an armory where elevators only access the basement. We also tried to follow the Yeoman Warder tour, included with the ticket price, but quickly lost sight of our red-jacketed beefeater guide when he took a route that included stairs. Luckily, Chloe wasn't interested in suits of armor, swords, or tales of beheadings. Instead, her heart was with the opulent, glittering crown jewels, which we visited without trouble. The Jewel House exhibition is fully accessible for anyone with mobility issues, which is really important for us at the Tower. Nicole Stockton Davies, Visitor Services Assistant Manager at the Tower of London, said via email. We have a powered lift-up to the viewing platform, and the direction of the moving walkways is regularly reversed for wheelchair users, so they still have a 360-degree view of the crown jewels. Outside of London, we found accessibility success at other sites, too, including ones that are even older than the nearly 1,000-year-old Tower of London, like the Roman Baths in Bath. The Roman Baths and Temple Precinct were built 2,000 years ago, and were never designed with disabled people in mind, and as the city has been built above the ruins over the centuries, they are below current street level. Katie Smith, Visitor Experience Manager for the Roman's Bath and Pump Room, said via email, "This makes the site very difficult to open up to anyone." Despite those challenges, Smith noted that 90% of the site is now step-free and accessible to wheelchair users. And she also notes, thanks to clever solutions that are permissible within the protected ancient status, they can make this even more accessible. For instance, workers suspended a new walkway over the temple precinct with very thin, super strong wire strands from the ceiling instead of resting it on the Roman stonework, and its four elevators were squeezed into spaces without disturbing anything of historic importance. For our family, even the step-free access of the Roman baths was challenging but manageable. Although the uneven stones around the great bath were difficult for the transport chair to move across, Chloe had no trouble walking over them using her forearm crutches, while I continually implored her, "Be careful and slow down," as she zoomed ahead of me on the slippery stone. Smith knows the uneven Roman pavement can present a mobility struggle. "We have been looking into buying some more wheelchairs with wider, softer wheels, which should be more comfortable to use," she said. Also coming in 2020 is a newly excavated area next to the Great Bath, which will have accessible interpretation and fully accessible walkways, she said. The site with the best accessibility was also the oldest, the Neolithic Stonehenge, which is about 5,000 years old and opened a new visitor center in 2013 that Page says allowed English heritage to radically improve access. Now all the visitor-friendly facilities and exhibition space are accessible to wheelchairs, pushchairs, and small mobility scooters, while state-of-the-art buses adapted for wheelchairs transport all visitors to the stone circle itself, from where there is a level circular route right around the monument, she said. Traveling to and around Stonehenge was not just possible for us, it was easy. We also experienced the site the same way every other visitor did, rather than having to take special circuitous routes or traverse makeshift ramps. Of course, the accessibility isn't just about mobility, which these sites also understand. That's why you can find accommodations like descriptive tours for the visually impaired and hidden disability lanyards for visitors to wear at the Tower of London, and British Sign Language tours on handheld devices, and free off-hours events for families with autism at the Roman Baths. The accessibility at some ancient sites was better than others. It was good at the medieval University of Oxford, but non-existent at Glastonbury Tour. Overall, I was pleasantly surprised by how easily accessible most historic sites were to us and other visitors with disabilities, especially since that hasn't always been our experience at home in the United States. City of Boston, take note, she adds. Plus, most of the sites offer free carer tickets for someone accompanying a person with a disability, so I paid admission for Chloe, but not for myself. In striving to reach everyone, we have to understand that a range of barriers are placed in the way of some people accessing our palaces, our stories, and the experiences we offer, said Stockton Davies. Whilst we can't go back 1,000 years to intervene in William the Conqueror's planning ambitions, we can at historic royal places, or palaces, I should say. Consider how our decisions in 2019 affect our broad range of visitors with this in mind. So very interesting story there, I think, to start us off. And as we continue, writer Will Hawks is going to take us on a journey in England with his article, "The British Museum is Full of Plunder. The Museum of London Reflects the City's Soul." This is from the November 14th, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. In the first section, the British Museum has ancient treasures from throughout the world. The British Museum is full of priceless plunder. Most of its exhibits were obtained when the British Empire covered almost a quarter of the world's land, including large chunks of Africa, North America, Australasia, and Asia. Pax Britannica being what it was, there's also plenty in the museum from bits of the map never painted pink, such as the Elgin Marbles, and removed from the Parthenon in Athens in the early 19th century. Moral qualms aside, this huge collection of global antiquities housed in London's grandest Greek Revival structure is unmissable for anyone interested in the history of human creativity. If you're fascinated by ancient Egypt and Sudan, there are 7 galleries of artifacts to enjoy, including the Rosetta Stone, taken as victor's spoils from the French in 1801. If you're passionate about Greece and Rome, there are delightful fragments from 2 of the ancient wonders of the world. The mausoleum at Halicarnassus and the Temple of Artemis. If Mesopotamia is your thing, there's more here of value than anywhere else outside of Iraq. It's no surprise that 6 million people visit each year. One culture the museum doesn't illuminate, though, is that of the city in which it is found. The British Museum, by its existence, shows us that London was once the capital of a huge empire that collected the shiniest jewels as it could lay its hands on, and that the results of that empire still resonate, but it doesn't say much about the history of or life in the capital. So for that, we have to go to another museum. So let's see where we're headed now. And before we do, I want to give you a quick location on the British Museum. It's on Great Russell Street in London. That's close to 4 underground stations. And those are Goodge Street, Russell Square, Tottenham Court, Court Road, and Holborn. Now, the Museum of London's collection hits closer to home and the heart in the next section. Head just over a mile east from the British Museum, though, and you'll find the Museum of London. Unlike the British Museum, this is not an impressive sight. It's an unwelcoming post-war muddle with huge brick walls and raised walkways partly situated on a roundabout in one of London's grayer spots. Inside, though, it is wonderful. Here, this remarkable city's story is told in fascinating, invigorating detail. From the Romans to the Victorians, from Oliver Cromwell's death mask to the 2012 Olympic cauldron, it's here, and like the British Museum, it's free to visit. My favorite permanent exhibit, Expanding City, details the story of London between 1670 and 1850, when the British capital went from provincial to patrician. It includes a wooden debtor's cell door from 1750 with graffiti engraved by the poor souls it trapped. That's human history. The temporary exhibits at the museum are invariably delightful, like the current Beast of London, which tells the story of the city through the eyes of the animals that have lived here over the centuries. It runs until January 5th. It's a must-see, particularly for those with children. Older visitors might enjoy an exhibit celebrating The Clash, one of London's archetypal rock bands, which runs from November 15th until April 19th. The museum has another location, the Museum of London Docklands, situated even farther east, close to the Canary Wharf. This branch, which details London's maritime history, includes an exhibit on how the country ascended to global dominance, London, sugar, and slavery. And then we have the main museum, which aims to move into a new, more elegant home in part of Smithfield Market, London's historic meat market, by 2024. Change is coming, hopefully for the better. In that and in many other ways, the Museum of London perfectly reflects the city it celebrates. And the Museum of London is found at 150 London Wall. It's a short walk from Barbican and St. Paul's stations. The Docklands branch is at No. 1 Warehouse, West India Quay, near the West Ferry and West India stations. By the way, our writer, Will Hawks, is a freelance travel and drinks writer, and he lives in London. So there you go. Someone who's in the know about London. So lots of fun there if you'd like to visit the London Museum. Well, like most of the places we have visited on Armchair Traveler, change is often a major theme, as we've already seen. King's Cross London is no exception. Writer Mart Van Hernacker tells us how he spent 36 hours in King's Cross in his article for the New York Times, which appeared December 12, 2019, and it was updated the following day in the online version. In a couple of the many headlines preceding the article, this will give you a kind of a hint of what's to come. Among the post-industrial chic buildings and stylish restaurants and shops, Victorian splendor, verdant hideouts, and the long-ago haunts of writers and musicians when we talk about King's Cross. And it also says King's Cross in Northern London, or North London, has seen dramatic change in recent years with the addition of shops, restaurants, offices, and notable structures that have been restored and in many cases repurposed. And Andy Haslam, by the way, wrote had some photographs that he took for the article written by, again, Mark Van Hunacker. Here we go. When I was young, I liked to read about cities I never dreamed I'd visit. And that's how I fell in love with the name of the London train station and neighborhood known as King's Cross, or King's X, as this most of English of place names was sometimes gracefully abbreviated. But when I first moved to England in 1996, grace wasn't so easy to find amid the widespread social and economic challenges that had come to define this corner of North London. Today, much, but by all means not all, of the neighborhood has been transformed by swank restaurants and shops, expensively repurposed industrial structures, and the glittering glass offices in which the gears of a decent chunk of London's booming knowledge economy turn ever faster. Welcome in these Brexit-tossed times to King's Cross and to one of London's most fascinating stories of adversity and renewal. And this is part of a series, 36 hours. We've had some stories from the New York Times in the past in this series. So we're going to have 36 hours in King's Cross. We start on a Friday at 2:30 in the afternoon. It's entitled Urban Fervor. For longtime residents, the transformation of King's Cross has meant opportunities, but also challenges, including gentrification, crowds, and controversies over facial recognition cameras. You're safe from all three at Calthorpe Community Garden, this verdant hideout, the product of community activism, on a site once earmarked for offices. Offers secluded benches, a swing, and a chance to wander past garden plots lovingly tended by some of London's friendliest strangers. Enjoy a cheese and pickle toasty at the Homey Cafe. That's £3.50, or if you want to put it in U.S. dollars, $4.50. The pickles are from cucumbers grown in the garden. We're going to be talking more about some pounds and as we continue. And a pound basically right now is about $1.30 U.S. currency. A British pound equal to about $1.30 in U.S. currency, so keep that in mind. Well, at 4 p.m., we're going to have A Tale of Two Stations, still on a Friday. Only a chilly Londoner, wrote E.M. Forster, would fail to find character in London's great railway terminals. To Margaret in Howard's End, King's Cross Station had always suggested infinity, and to think she never saw the new concourse opened in 2012, which added soaring space and much-needed light to a hub that's busier than many airports. Keep an eye out for the sign for Platform 9 3/4, where Harry Potter caught the express to Hogwarts, then crossed the street to spellbinding St. Pancras International Station, a hub for commuter and national services, as well as high-speed Eurostar trains to continental Europe. The battle to preserve and restore this Victorian Gothic masterpiece took decades, and many Londoners would agree that it's now the jewel in the crown of railway terminals that encircle the capital. Welcome just-embarked Parisians with a tune on the public pianos, one signed gift from Elton John. Then snag a selfie with the statue of the poet John Benjamin, whose advocacy helped save the station, or with the gold-leafed 18-foot-wide clock. After the previous clock was dropped by a crane in the 1960s, a train guard gathered the shards in a wheelbarrow and took them home to his farm. Dent, the clockmakers responsible for Big Ben, and another firm relied on those fragments to create the replica that is seen today. At 5 p.m., it's happy hours. The old ticket office at St. Pancras Station was the very image of Victorian splendor. Now it's home to the booking office, one of my favorite bars. Here, just yards from gleaming Eurostar trains, fate Angelo or Anglo-Continental harmonies with a lavender vesper, 13 pounds. This is a drink. An entente cordial that includes Chase Vodka and gin from Hertfordshire, French vermouth, and the bee pollen from Lily's Sebastopol Market. then stick your landing at the German Gymnasium, one of Britain's first purpose-built gyms when it opened in the 1860s. Today it's a buzzing restaurant. The parallel bars are gone, though grabbing a prime-time reservation here might qualify as an Olympic event. Award yourself the Schupfnudgen, a hand-rolled potato noodles, celerac, mushroom, truffles, and butter sauce, all for £19.50. There you go. And then number four at 7:30. It's only last night I found myself lost as we close out our Friday evening. My musical introduction to King's Cross came via the song with the same name by the Pet Shop Boys, the British techno dance pop duo. The tough neighborhood in which the group's lead singer, Neil Tennant, found a haunting metaphor for Thatcherite Britain was also home to a thriving club scene. Today, concerts at St. Pancras Old Church showcase mostly emerging artists, as well as the likes of Phoebe Bridgers, Sam Smith, and Sinead O'Connor. On January 17th, the London-born Patrick Wolfe imagined The Cure channeling Bruce Springsteen. According to the Telegraph, will perform, and tickets go from £22 and up. Or see who's playing at the Water Rats, the pub that in former incarnation hosted Bob Dylan's first British concert, and that was in 1962. And then we had the Pogues' first concert in 1982, and the first London show of Oasis in 1994. Well, that's all we can do on a Friday. Our 36 hours in King's Cross, London, will continue on a Saturday now, and we start at 10 a.m., and we shop until blank, blank, blank. In the mid-19th century, a set of buildings was constructed to allow coal to be lowered from just-arrived trains and then packed for distribution across London. Today, Coal Drops Yard, renovated by Heatherwick Studio, the King's Cross-based firm that also designed the vessel at Manhattan's Hudson Yards, is home to a shopping venue that's the epitome of post-industrial chic. Start at Wolf and Badger, a high-end stockist of independent artisans, where you can prepare for winter with vegan lip balm by Hertfordshire-based Evolve Beauty. That's going to set you back £12. And English-spun merino wool wear by Peregrine, founded in 1796. Now, scarves and olive or wheat go for £47. Move on to Tom Dixon's Interior Design Shop, where the star attractions are the geometrically swirling spring pendant lamps from £565 and up. And remember, I told you, each pound is worth $1.30 U.S., so there you go. Finally, in a metropolitan, or finally in a metropolis in which homelessness is rising, don't miss Boutique by Shelter. Purchases of donated designer and vintage items, including the occasional Hermes mask or handbag and Burberry suit, benefit Shelter, a prominent homelessness charity. Then we have, at 11 o'clock, A Mad Day Out. Thought we were already there. But anyway, it's hard to believe that St. Pancras Old Church was once a riverside country chapel distinguished by its origins. The church claims to have been a site of Christian worship since the 4th century. Its well-stocked graveyard, the scene of body snatching in Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, and its distance from a much smaller London, walk not there too late, as one 16th century chronicler summarized the church's ritual of thief-ridden environments. Then we have the customizable tours of highly recommended. Ask your guide about the shape of British phone boxes, disinterments on a scale that would make Stephen King blanch, and potential visits from a motley gallery of ghosts, including Mary Shelley, John Lennon, and the son of Benjamin Franklin. Wow, that sounds like an interesting time. Yeah. Better perhaps to do it around noon, huh? Well, by 1 p.m., we're going to be digging in on Saturday. Of all the alterations that the Industrial Revolution inflicted on Britain's landscape, few are as pleasing as the Regent's Canal, cut in the early 19th century to link the Grand Union Canal at Paddington to the River Thames at Limehouse. Stroll along the towpaths overgrown with sycamore, ash, and willow, then stop at Word on the Water, a bookshop on a canal boat where you can warm your hands over the wood stove and commune with Star, an elderly beagle collie who spent her whole life on boats. By 3 p.m., we're in Royal London. King's Place is home to the offices of the Guardian newspaper and also to one of London's best curated selections of concerts, talks, and exhibitions. Start your explorations at Pangolin, London, a sculpture-focused gallery that has art trail around the complex. If you pinwheel backwards in the icy canal while admiring the works, as I nearly did, the Rotunda restaurant offers hot chocolate and warm blankets on its waterside deck. By 6:30 that evening, this is Saturday evening, things turn sweet and bitter. Yotam Ottolenghi, the chef and cookbook author and Times contributor, is a fan of walks along the Regent's Canal. His kids play in the fountains of Granary Square, and the most popular of his London restaurants is in nearby Islington. In other words, he's the perfect Londoner to take yours truly on a food tour of the new King's Cross. For a quick bite, he recommended the tasty too-big-to-finish sandwiches from Bodega Rita's. For a proper meal, he chose Barrafina, an upscale tapas restaurant, where he ordered his go-to dishes, a roast negro with cuttlefish and Iberian pork, that's 21 pounds, the classic tortilla for 9 pounds, and a green salad for 5 pounds. I won't forget how joyfully my favorite chef scraped out the last of the roast negro. When it caramelizes, it goes sweet and bitter, he explained. It's a different world when you hit the bottom of the pan. So remember that. Well, with tummies full, we take a break as we prepare to continue our 36 hours in King's Cross, London, on a Sunday. And we get up and get going around 10 a.m. for Somers time. That's spelled S-O-M-E-R-S. Squeezed between St. Pancras and Euston stations is the quiet, mostly residential neighborhood of Somers Town. Start with a walk on the Ostleton Estate, completed not long before World War II in the heart of what had been known as the Somers Town slum. This homage to Viennese-style modernism has been described as one of London's most architecturally important housing projects. Then stop outside 15 Phoenix Road. That's the former home of Henry Croft, the orphans, street sweeper, and rat catcher behind the Pearly Kings and Queens, a uniquely London working-class tradition still going strong that involves charitable fundraising, inherited titles, and elaborately pearl-bedecked garb. Finally, rest your feet at the Somers Town Coffee House, a pub, despite the name, that feels as local as anything could in this cosmopolitan corner of town. An English breakfast, including vegan options, started £8. And then by 11 o'clock, I'm sorry, at 12 o'clock by noon, we have the Mother Tongue. Its written culture has a center of gravity. It's lurking somewhere in the stacks of the British Library. The collection, the world's second largest, contains more than 170 items. In terms of shelf space, it grows by 5 miles per year. And behind-the-scenes tours, and you can book online for £10 and finish in the Treasures Gallery, home to the 4th-century Codex Sinaiticus, the earliest surviving Bible to contain the complete New Testament, handwritten first drafts of Beatles lyrics, a 9th-century Chinese version of the Diamond Sutra, a Buddhist text described as the world's earliest dated printed book in Jane Austen's desk. And before time runs out on us, let me give you a couple of quick tours. We'll kind of abbreviate this. At 2 p.m., with fear contended with desire, quote, around Caledonian Road are numerous monuments to an older King's Cross. You start outside Scala, once London's legendary cinema of sin. A filmmaker called it a country club for criminals and lunatics, and while my friend recalls hauling shopping bags full of homemade popcorn to her first experiences of cult, horror, and pioneering LGBT films here. Today, the Scala houses a nightclub. Next up is the nonprofit Houseman's Bookshop, named for Lawrence Houseman, peace activist, suffragist, and younger brother of the poet A.E. Houseman. And this is a haven for anti-establishment, which opened in King's Cross in 1959. And with that, my friends, we have concluded another tour and journey on today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available as a podcast at the broadcast at ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.